such an overwhelming holiday that any other calendar celebration at this time of year is swept under and away by the undertow. People born within the immediate Christmas constellation end up with names like Gloria, Holly, and Noel, and spend the rest of their lives either complaining or boasting because they have to share their natal day with that of the Savior's. If I were to be canonized, I would also, for similar selfish reasons, most vehemently object to having my Saints' Day at this time of year. This is the first time, it's not beyond the realm of possibility, this is the first time that I can remember that the seminary community has ever celebrated the festival of St. Thomas, and it is only because we are taking our Christmas break a little later than usual. Other holidays scheduled for this season include St. Stephen's, Holy Innocents, and St. John's. St. Stephen is remembered because a certain old King Wenceslas went out on that day to help a poor beggar in the snow. Holy Innocents should be a day of mourning to commemorate those infants who today die before they are born. And on that day, we should ask God in his sovereign mercy and might to remove the scalpels from the bloody hands of the modern Herods. The name Thomas immediately suggests doubting. And rather than use the Apostle St. Thomas as a negative example, it would be more kind and definitely more courteous to say nothing about him at all. Any positive statement about Thomas comes from tradition and legend, which is always suspect, which places him in India, where he allegedly died the martyr's death by working on a church roof, a kind of self-redeeming act for a man who hesitated in believing the Lord's resurrection. In every age, there are some Christians who feel the desperate need to follow in the footsteps of St. Thomas by demanding to see the evidence before they commit themselves fully to the apostolic message. They sincerely want to believe, but they are reserving their final opinion until they have an opportunity to examine more evidence. They are skeptics, but they are not agnostics. They are rationalists, but they do not despise the opinions of others. If the evidence is so compelling that only one conclusion is possible, then they insist, perhaps quite correctly, that the evidence should speak for itself. These people are the iconoclasts of tradition. From time to time, the church needs these iconoclasts to sort out the pious chaff of human tradition going about disguised as the wheat of biblical orthodoxy. Luther himself was such a doubter of the current message. Tradition, old or new, must occasionally be examined by the church. Thomas was more of an outright unbeliever than a doubter. He simply said that without the physical evidence, at least more of it, he would not believe. He was really not that much worse than any of the other disciples who believed first only when they saw the empty tomb and not when they had heard the message of the resurrection from Mary Magdalene. Thomas was the unbeliever. The disciples were more the doubters. There is no suggestion, absolutely no exception, there is no suggestion at all that the disciples embraced with any enthusiasm at all or with believing hearts the message that Jesus had risen from the dead. No one went to that tomb as a believer, and no one believed the word of the women. Quite to the contrary, the Emmaus disciples knew of the report of the resurrection and told Jesus that the women had allegedly had a vision of angels. Thomas believed no one, neither the women nor the 10 disciples. He was magnificent in his consistent skepticism. He trusted the word of no one. Thomas should not be faulted for demanding to examine the evidence for himself. If he is to be faulted, it should be for failing to examine the evidence already provided by the empty tomb of Jesus. Even when the enemies of Jesus asked for signs, he did not tell them to take the plunge of faith into the Word. He did not say, "See what religion will do in your heart." But rather, he said, "Consider the signs which are already given." Thomas, who prided himself for being a rationalist in thought and scientific in his approach for demanding to see the resurrection evidence, was not really that intellectual which he really thought himself to be. But then again, he was typical of most intellectuals who are only intellectuals because they think themselves to be. His reason, regardless of whether it was the magisterial or the ministerial use of it, had not sifted through the evidence that was already there. It is not contrary to Christian faith for both the believer and the unbeliever to ask to see the evidence for himself. John, who wrote this gospel, tells us that he came to faith only after he had entered the empty tomb and examined for himself the condition of the burial cloths. Mark's gospel, which has no record at all of any of the resurrection appearances of Jesus, leaves us with no other possible conclusion that the empty tomb, together with the prior preaching of Jesus, is sufficient evidence to convince the unconvinced skeptic. Perhaps in each of us there should be a little bit more of that John or Thomas, which looks at the evidence without simply taking the words of others, regardless of the power and the piety and the sanctification of the word of those great speakers. Christian truth dare never be based upon the faith of any believer, or upon the faith of the church, or of Peter, or even for that matter, on the dogmatical tradition of the church. Fideism, that total and irrational abandon of the soul, occasionally has to be flushed through with a good corrective dose of the skepticism of Thomas. Skepticism, virtue or vice, is a mark of the times, and both Christians and seminary students are demanding more evidence and not less evidence for faith. Is it really a mystery that men like C.S. Lewis and John Montgomery and Paul Meyer and perhaps even Pottenberg are popular because they are claiming that if Christianity really is an historical religion, then there should be no fear at looking at the evidence? Is it really a sin to climb Mars Hill? Is it really a sin to climb the heights of Jerusalem to search for the Ark? Do we really have to say that it's Romanism to be convinced that the Shroud of Turin really might have been the one purchased by Joseph of Arimathea to wrap the body of the Lord? The historical skeptics, whose patron saint must be Saint Thomas, have been a positive benefit to the Christian faith by sweeping bare the dust of pious opinion and laying bare the crude historical undergirdings of the Holy Gospel. In their demanding that faith first be anchored in fact, the skeptics have prevented the church from sailing aimlessly around on a placid sea of glassy-eyed mysticism. They have moored a helium-floating Christianity to earth and reality where it belongs. The confrontation between the Lord and Thomas, and the awareness of Thomas that Jesus indeed had come back from the dead, motivated the evangelist to soar into these words, and many other signs truly did Jesus do in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that ye might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing ye might have life. The challenging skepticism of Thomas has not destroyed the faith, but like the transfiguration, has made the apostolic and the prophetic word more sure by pointing specifically to the verifying event of our salvation. All the evidence points to the fact that the evangelist wanted to conclude his gospel with the Thomas episode, with chapter 21 added as a later appendage. Then all of a sudden, it becomes evident that Thomas and the Christmas account are bound together. The prologue, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth." Those words must sooner or later demand the challenge of Thomas that unless I examined the flesh with my own flesh, I will not believe that the Word was made flesh for me and for our salvation. In every age, the church, like Jesus, will confront those who believe right away, but they will also confront the skeptical Thomases, some of whom might be here this morning. Those who believe can appreciate the words of Jesus. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. But for the skeptic, these words are meaningless, and worse, these words are a curse on him. In handling Thomas, apparently Jesus had no interest at all in demonstrating the truth of the statement that the word and not the evidence converts. Because if Jesus had believed that, Jesus would have never appeared to Thomas and merely sent messages to him from a hiding place until Thomas believed the word. With the skeptic today, the church has no other choice but to present the evidence with all patience, the evidence that Jesus did in fact live and die and rise from the dead in our own time and on our own earth. Resurrection is the evidence of the incarnation, and incarnation is the basis of the atonement and our salvation. Thanks to the skepticism of Thomas, we today can celebrate both Christmas and Easter with a little bit more certainty. Many see John's gospel as a protest against Gnosticism, a belief that robbed Bethlehem's stable of the incarnate God and left us hardly more than a disgruntled Prophet Mohammed-like baby, fomenting ethical demands punctuated by threats of amputation of our limbs and heads. Demythologizing, again, in our time and in our church, has stuck its prominent and deadly nose into the tents of our churches and has threatened to rob the cradle again. Occasionally, the church has to examine the historical evidence to make sure that there in that manger is the child which the church adores as the incarnate God, the Son of God, the Word of the Father, the brightness and the image of the Father, the firstborn of all creation. Right there in that cradle is the Word made flesh, the foundation of our salvation. I think if I were St. Thomas and had showed up at Christmas instead of at Easter, the first thing I would have done even before worshiping that holy infant, I think I would have picked him up to see if he was all there. Regardless of whether you admire Thomas or whether you are a faith-filled believer who feels obligated to toss a few stones in his direction on his day, how much greater will it be when faith gives way to the greater reality of seeing with our eyes the God-man who is today only seen by faith and is absent from sight. If you really examine your life and are somewhat honest, you might find that you are a little bit more skeptical like Thomas than what you really want to admit. Merry Christmas, and we will sing the last two verses of Once in Royal David City.